We're all of us happy that the two men have come back to us. Bogo hides his treasures in a corner so no one can find them. The very next moment we're blasted almost off our feet. A deafening blast shakes what's left of the house. Another attack. We hear the airplanes roar past overhead. Bombs, mines, shells and shrapnel of all sizes beat the ground and the walls around and over us. The explosions come closer and closer, and after each of them we hear tiles and bricks and rubble tumbling down overhead. The barrage of fire is so continuous it sounds as if it might be some gigantic, cosmic sewing machine. Any moment the next shell may burst through the ceiling overhead, our last protection, and blow us all to kingdom come. We sit there mute and cold in this horrible anxiety, in deathly fright and fear of death. How long can the walls hold? Then, a gigantic blast, so powerful the whole cellar floor dances beneath us. And my father's chambermaid suddenly starts to scream with a nervous shock. The other women servants start screaming too. I jump up and yell at the top of my lungs, "Quiet! Quiet! God is here! God is here!" Explosion follows explosion, so loud they can hardly hear my voice. But I keep on shouting. I just have to shout at the top of my lungs, "God is here. Let all of us, everyone, think only of God, nothing else. Only of God. God be with us. God!" God! God! And one by one the others join me as we repeat together, "God is here. God. God. God." None of us knows how long this has gone on. Little by little the pandemonium outside has lessened. The blasts have become less frequent, and at last it's quiet outside. We can hear soldiers dragging something heavy. I go out to have a look. On the stairs arc bodies lying motionless. On the floor is blood. I recognize several of the young soldiers. Only an hour ago they were seeking warmth with us in the shelter, telling us about their homes and families far away. Their poor parents. Waiting in vain for their children to come home. My son. Where can the poor boy be now? In what department of hell? Then we grab a bite to eat. We know we have to take advantage of every moment of calm. We have to strengthen our body's resistance. As long as we have anything to eat. Two men go out to get water. How long have we been sitting here in this shelter? Weeks have gone by while we've been in this barrage of hellfire. My husband reminisces, in Dobodo, in the First World War, we were caught in a barrage of fire too. But every 48 hours we were relieved. People thought a person's nerves couldn't stand any more than that. I never dreamed I would one day be sitting through an unending barrage, together with women and children, for several weeks, and without any relief. We all sit there in furs and heavy winter coats. None of us has been able to take off a stitch of clothing ever since we came down to this dungeon. Little Peter is lying in my arms. With one hand I hang on to the little suitcase containing money, my jewelry, and a box of cakes by way of food supply for the babe in arms in case we have to flee. We are all of us ready to jump. The villa next to ours was burnt out with flamethrowers. My husband has given orders to everyone to be ready to flee at a moment's notice. We don't know when the enemy may set fire to our house and drive us out with flamethrowers. But flee where? We haven't the vaguest idea. Only out and away from here. Our neighbor and his son were both picked off with sharpshooters while they were trying to escape from their burning house. Only his wife came out alive. She crawled and wriggled on her stomach all the way to the fourth house down the street, where people took her in. We wait in readiness, my younger sister with her babe in arms. My snowy-haired father wrapped in his big black fur coat, my elder sister's family, my brother, our servants, all tense, all holding our most precious possessions all ready to jump and run. Then for a little while it's quiet outside again. We'd like to get some sleep. My nerves are burning and my head feels ready to split. I close my eyes and try to withdraw my consciousness and fall asleep. But then the baby starts to scream with its shrill penetrating voice. My sister tries to quiet it, but it keeps on crying and screaming without a moment's intermission. I take over the child from my sister and try everything I can think of, but it keeps on crying, crying desperately. I hand the child back to my sister, and it still goes on crying, crying. In the darkness, Boga stumbles over to my sister, picks up the child, holds it gently in his arms and starts humming a tune from his far away home soft-land. It's a tune his countrymen use to control snakes. The child quiets down instantly. As calm returns to our cellar, we all of us fall asleep, sitting there just as we are. Only Boga is awake, holding the baby in his arms and humming his exotic little tune. More days go by, or are they weeks? We don't even bother to ask any more. Behind a protective wall in the garden, my husband scrapes together some snow, brings the pail downstairs and shaves in the next room in the cellar. He refused to give up his habits. All the other men have bushy beards. Only my husband and Boga keep on shaving day by day in the midst of this hell. Then my husband sits down beside us. A new attack begins and we endure the torture for hours on end. My sister brings her baby's bottle and gives him his meal. 4 times a day she goes upstairs to her flat and cooks for her baby, despite the hail of bullets flying around. After her child has had its fill, she comes to me and asks, just as she asks every day, "Do you think it's over yet?" "No," I whisper back. "I just feel it isn't over yet." A moment later a mini bursts directly over our head. Once again we hear tiles and bricks and mortar and wood falling. The shelter ceiling has held up under the blast. But how much longer? We sit there quietly, and I ask God within me, "Shall I get ready to die? My horoscope says I'm going to die in the crash of a building. Is it now? Am I going to die, or shall I go on fighting to live?" Then suddenly amidst the darkness I behold a vision, a tiny little hill, and on it a candle, a tiny one like a Christmas tree candle, burning with a tiny flame. Then before my very eyes, the little hill begins to grow, turning into a big hill covered with emerald green grass. And the tiny candle grows into a torch, burning with a bright strong flame. The vision disappears, but I know I am not going to die yet. I'm going to have to be this torch. I'm going to have to bring people light, 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 light. At night the baby cries incessantly until Boga picks it up and lulls it to sleep. While we're trying to sleep a mine explodes nearby, and afterwards I feel ice cold air come into our shelter. The men jump up to see what's happened. The cellar wall has caved in, leaving a gaping hole. We all think of the coming attack. We wait. I whisper to my younger sister, "Now it's the end. In the morning our villa will be taken." "Yes," she answers, "I think so too, or else we'll all die." My husband whispers, "It's 7 weeks to the day that we've been sitting here in the shelter." Strangely enough, the enemy cannon have ceased firing. No bombs are falling either. We hear only continuous machine gun fire. Sitting next to me, my husband whispers into my ear, "That means the infantry is quite near us. They've stopped using field guns in order not to hit their own troops. Enemy soldiers may walk in any minute." In the afternoon I go out to see where father is. As I step out of the shelter and look out through the door of the house, I see foreign soldiers running towards us from the burnt down villa next door. "Father, father, and all the rest of you," I scream as I run back, "the enemy is here." We all rush back into the shelter just as enemy soldiers lunge through the door, their rifles at the ready. Deathly silence. We and they look at each other for a seemingly endless moment. It's as if time itself were standing still. All the soldiers are dressed in broad white coats. Outside everything is covered with snow. The soldiers look like children playing in a Christmas pageant. Then with a word we cannot understand, their leader points to the women. We understand we must move to the right, and we do so. Then with another incomprehensible word, he points to the men, who all have to leave immediately with one of the soldiers. No time for fond farewells. The men are gone, and we women remain alone with the foreign soldiers. With their sub-soft hyphen machine guns in readiness, they poke into every corner of the cellar, looking for any of our troops who might be hiding there. One young soldier steps over to the pram where the baby is sleeping. Even as he looks at it, tears come into his eyes. With infinite tenderness, he says a strange word in a foreign language. Nevertheless, we understand, little baby. Then he looks at us and points in the direction of his homeland, telling us high sign language that he too has a little baby at home. I feel somewhat consoled as I note that these soldiers are loving, kind, soft-hearted human beings too. Now an officer comes, sits down on a chair, and tells us in a European language, "We won't harm you. We are storm troops. Sons of people who now belong to an exterminated class. But watch out, we have to go on. Behind us there'll come soldiers of another kind. They're not like us. Watch out." Late in the afternoon the shooting begins again. But now the fire is coming from our country's own soldiers. They want to recapture our house. Again we sit still in the dark cellar and listen to horrible fighting going on at close quarters in the street outside. All of a sudden there is another deafening explosion, followed by a stream of cold air coming in on us. The explosion has blasted open the heavy iron shutter of the cellar window. Through the open window bullets rain in on us like hailstones. We all jump to one side, flattening ourselves against the walls, but this way we are unable to move. In this situation every one of our lives is in danger. A single step can mean death. The heavy iron window shutter must be closed. I look about me. All the women and children seek refuge by flattening themselves against the wall near the window. For the moment any one of us shows herself in front of the window, a shower of bullets rains in upon us. This situation is untenable. The shutter must be closed. I feel a strange chill within me. My every nerve is cold, frozen, so cold I can't feel myself at all. Afraid? I ask myself. No. Who is there to be afraid within me when I feel as if I didn't even exist? I only know that I am the one who must close the iron shutter. Nevertheless, I observe myself curiously. What does it feel like to be in such a position? What does a person experience? How does nature react within the human being when we involuntarily have to be a hero? Standing in one corner of the cellar is a heavy walking stick with a curved handle. Lying flat on the floor, I crawl slowly and cautiously over to the cane. Then, grasping its lower end, I crawl back towards the window. While I'm executing this maneuver, a weird thought flashes through my head. The candidates in the pyramid had to pass a test of defying death. Maybe I am now passing this same test here in the shelter? Maybe this is all only a dream during my initiation in the pyramid? While I crawl back cautiously to the window, my intellect replies, yes, the candidates in the pyramid had it easy. They knew they were only undergoing a test in their initiation. But these bullets aren't dreams. They really kill. How many poor young soldiers have already lost their lives right here? Nevertheless, the window shutter must be closed, and for that very reason. Kneeling beneath the window and holding the cane in readiness, I suddenly jump up and poke out my arm and the cane through the window. Then, noting that the iron shutter has been blasted wide open, I find I must extend my head and shoulder through the window in order to reach the edge of the shutter with the cane's curved handle. I have to reach out and stretch until I feel as if my whole body were getting longer. Finally, I have the shutter and draw it slowly, surely, inward. Now my sisters jump up to help, pull the heavy iron shutter into place and bolt it firmly closed. Well done. All very simple. No excitement, no theatrics, no histrionics. And yet how strange. Up till now the sharpshooters across the street poured a hail of fire into our window at the slightest sign of life. And yet throughout my whole maneuver to close the iron shutter, they didn't fire a single shot. Maybe they were being prevented from shooting, or simply didn't want to shoot, because they saw I was a woman. Aunt Esther, begs little Peter, tell me another story. And so I go on telling stories by the hour. The next day we women had to flee from our bombed out house. The intervening night was one of indescribable horror. I can hardly believe that such things can really happen. The conquest of a country is like the meeting of male and female power in a violent marriage. One country conquers another, forces its way into the body of the other. Blood flows. Individual inhabitants die like the cells of the ravished body, and yet new life comes forth from this meeting. A new world, a new creation. The meeting is cruel and violent, just as the creation of new life always is. But nature only looks forward into the future, willingly sacrificing countless individual cells and beings in order to reach its goal of bringing forth new life. And new life does come forth, both on the spiritual and on the material level, from the intimate meeting of two countries, that of the conqueror and that of the conquered. Out of the marriage of two countries, a new civilization arises. The cells of the bodies of these two countries meet and mingle, bringing forth children with some of the characteristics of both races. Nature creates hybrid races and individuals who represent a transition, softening and bridging over the hard boundaries between races and nations. It was my fate to learn this fact that night in the air raid shelter of that bombed out house. I was forced to look on and see that the violent marriage of two nations is very cruel and causes many individual tragedies. It was Ima who saved me from the fate that overtook almost all the women in that house that night. When one of the soldiers started to drag me from my seat in the corner of the shelter, forcing me to follow him, I told him in a pidgin version of his language, "I, mother, son in war, you have mother at home too, please go away." In the half-drunk eyes of the poor young man whose body had been poisoned with storm pills, there flashed an expression of understanding. I saw that he was forced to think of his own mother. Then with a gesture of frustration and rage, he pushed me back under the bench and stormed out of the cellar. The next morning we felt an inner command to flee from the bombed out house. We felt the guidance of a higher power. For reasons beyond our comprehension, it saved us from the fate awaiting all women, without exception, in the ruins of our house. Everything happened as if in a chaotic dream. After 5 weeks in darkness, we step out suddenly into bright sunshine, so bright our eyes can hardly stand it. I cast a backward glance at our big beautiful villa. A pile of rubble. Topped off by broken beams pointing their splintered ends skyward. Then we run across the street, picking our way between corpses and rubble, over to the steps. My sister carries her babe in soft hyphen arms. As I watch, I see her plunge down the steps in the deep snow. I run to her side, help her up, then fall over myself with the little boy I am holding by the hand. Under the snow are wire obstacles. While we are trying to climb over with the children, an elderly soldier of the enemy army lifts the little boy over the wire barrier, then helps all the rest of us over. The women and the children, one after the other. I am the last. We cannot talk to the soldier. We wouldn't understand each other. But we look into each other's eyes, and I give him a hearty handshake in sincere appreciation. He reciprocates the handshake. Then we run on, zigzagging back and forth in search of cover from the mines which are still exploding and from the bullets falling about us. The children yell at the top of their lungs. The snow is too deep for little Peter. So with all my might and main I drag him along stretched out flat behind me because he isn't able to walk. From time to time we stop under a terrace to catch our breath and to warm the children's hands by blowing on them. Then we run on, scarcely knowing which way we're going, driven onwards. Or led on. By an inner power. And it's like a dream to be taken into a house at long last where a good-natured officer of the enemy army protects us from violence at the hands of his own comrades. As we get to be good friends, he tells me, "Mama, watch out. One good soldier, 10 bad soldiers. Not all the men in our army would give you protection the way I'm doing. Watch out when I get orders to move on." Yes, we know all enemy soldiers are not so humane. We have the experiences of our first night behind us, and will never forget them. and the men have disappeared. All except Father, whom we have soon found again. Calmly, without excitement, paying no attention to the cannonade going on around him, the old gentleman walked through this scene of mass murder, and while everyone else was being robbed of everything he possessed, fur, coat, gloves, money, watch, fountain pen, and everything else one can carry on his person, my father arrived safe and sound in the home of an old friend without a single soldier's having so much as touched him. His powerful radiation even affected the enemy soldiers and kept them away from him. Then a few days later there is a knock on the door of this strange room in a strange house where 14 people, soldiers, refugees and we women and children, are living. A knock on the door, and Bogar stands before us, in tattered clothes, with bleeding feet. After all he has been through, it's a miracle he's still alive. Neighbors told him the direction in which they saw us flee. He has found us again. A few days later my brother comes back, also in tatters. He too has had to travel several hundred kilometers. Somewhere he found himself two shoes, both of them for the left foot, and wears them both with his accustomed dignity. He's alive, that's all that matters. As the days go by I still have no news from my husband. I can't seem to get the thought out of my head that I've seen him one day, in a vision, lying helpless in the snow beside the road. What could have happened to him? After long weeks of waiting in vain, I finally find my husband, gravely injured, in the house of a good-hearted farmer. My vision wasn't wrong. Months go by. We're hungry and don't know where our next meal is coming from. But one day, at long last, the war is over. We try to make some rooms in the ruins of our house inhabitable. Bogar and I work day and night to get something to eat in this time of terrible famine. My husband is forced to lie flat on his back for many long months until he recovers sufficiently to be able to walk about cautiously with two canes. How fortunate I am, a sculptress. I do bricklaying, take doors out of the remnants of walls, and move them to where we need them. We put together window frames. Having no glass, we cover them with heavy wrapping paper. Digging in the rubble with our 10-finger nails, we bring out a few usable pots and pans, plus some bent and beaten silverware. Bogar and I manage to borrow a cart and use it to bring home several hundred weight of coal, pulling all the way like two strong horses. Downhill, we find it hard to keep the cart from running away from us. Uphill, it takes all our pushing and pulling to get it up to the top, where we reach a level street again and can trot along lightly and gaily. Then we clean up the remnants of our furniture, using miscellaneous odd bits to make new pieces. We keep on hammering and nailing things together until at last we are able to reopen our yoga school in the ruins of our old home. Bogar gives lessons in the physical exercises he learnt from Mentopter, while I teach what I learned in Egypt from Tahotep. Months go by again, and little by little the problem of finding food becomes somewhat less acute. Our pupils who have relatives living in the country bring us an occasional handful of flour, a few potatoes, eggs, and once in a while even a bit of butter. But I still have no news from my son. Then one day, after a year and a half of waiting, someone rings our doorbell. I open the door, and Emma stands before me. I would have thought that in such cases mother and son would fall about each other's necks with loud cries and sobs. But no. I look at him in surprise, then we embrace each other quietly and earnestly. I draw a deep breath of relief. He is alive and not crippled. Only a scar on his beautiful, high forehead shows that he has been through an airplane crash. But still I am deeply dismayed. I know I'm well enough to know there is no room for him in this country where vulgarity, brutality, stupidity and utter chaos are the order of the day. And without jeopardizing life and limb excessively, a person can experience such conditions only if he preserves his inner peace, his perfect trust in God and keeps silent. But Ima won't keep silent. He doesn't understand that we're not in the temple now where love and truth and unselfishness prevail and where everyone may speak his opinion freely without risk of being misunderstood. Ima won't be able to get along in this world. He won't tolerate injustice, and he'll want to fight against the infernal spirit prevailing here now. Apparently he has forgotten who he is, and yet he has retained his high-mindedness, honesty and courage and expects the sons of men to display these same virtues. He insists on believing in people, and he has crowded off into the unconscious part of his being his indomitable faith in God. Poor Ima has to experience one disappointment after another. Why does he repress his faith in God? Why does he refuse to believe in God? That's the reason why he's lost his self-confidence. I can see that he must have experienced a serious mental crack-up. But when and where? And why do I have the strange and oppressing feeling that I have been the cause of this mental rupture, a horrible disappointment? I know that somewhere, sometime, he has lost his faith because of me, but in vain I seek the reason. One thing I know with absolute certainty is that it is up to me to lead him back to God, and that's why he has become my son. I must awaken his self-confidence, which is identical with confidence in God, and make him conscious again of this confidence, because I was to blame for his having lost it. I must realize that the deep love and confidence he has in me is only a projection of the profound confidence in God he has in the unconscious part of his soul. He must come to realize that he has to learn to recognize and love God in every person. The person is only an outer cover, a mask, through which God manifests himself. Ima must learn that what he loves in any person, and what he finds good, beautiful and true in anyone is God and not the person. And that applies to me too, whom he loves, I know it, more than anyone else here on earth. It's up to him to lead this love in him back to God. He must come to realize that he loves God in me too, and my person is only an instrument through which God manifests himself in the form of maternal love. Ima has yet to learn that in every person who loves him it is really God who loves him and not the person. When he realizes these things he will understand me and everyone else and even himself better. Then he won't experience any more disappointments. And there comes a night in which my one and only child, the person I love most here on earth, is living in an unheated room during an unusually cold winter when the thermometer has been dragging along at 20 degrees below zero for week after week. My one and only child doesn't even have a warm blanket and has scarcely anything to eat. I could easily provide a heated room for him, I could give him food and everything else he needs. But I know I must not. I know it's more important for him not to lose his soul than his body. Out of love for him I must be cruel. I kneel in the darkness in my bed and speak to my God, "You be with him, O God, and let him find himself and you again. Let him find the way that leads to you, and let him never deviate from it. Awaken him. Awaken yourself in him, O God, for you are also dwelling in him and you must awaken in him so that he may awaken, for my strength is inadequate." He must become conscious. Unless he does so he's lost, and you know the one and only path for him to follow in order to recognize you, O Lord my God, in himself. You know why he feels he has been forsaken by everyone. Why he's convinced that even I have forsaken him. He has to feel disappointed in everyone, he has to give up hope in everyone in order to find you. In order to become conscious in you, conscious of himself. You know, O God, that I don't see any other possibility of saving him. I cannot and must not show my love for him anymore. He must find you by his own efforts. I am only a weak human being, my Lord, but you are God, love itself. You love him more than I can love him. You, O God, are always with him. Love him now with your divine love. Now when I must be cruel. Take care of him and keep him from losing his health during this present struggle of his. While he's going through this school. You know that he's sinning against his health because he has no confidence in himself anymore. Because in his unconscious he would like to die. To kill himself. Take care of him, open his spiritual eyes and don't forsake him, don't forsake him, don't forsake him. And so I go on night after night. One night as I'm kneeling in my bed in the darkness again, preparing to speak to God about my child, something strange happens, to my great amazement, It begins to get light about me.